Young Turks, Hannah Cranston here with Miss Ambria Allen and Mark Thompson, of course, sticking around for the second hour. We have a chock full hour for you guys, so I want to dive right into it. Some serious stories, we do have some fun stories. We're gonna finish on a story about Wonder Woman, and then afterwards in the post game, I will tell you guys about a crazy story that happened to me when I went to go see Wonder Woman last weekend. So make sure that you are a member so that you can see post games like this. How was the first hour, Mark?
It was very good, although too many guys on the panel in the first hour. This is really an upgrade for me, so thank you.
Well, we're glad to be here for that. Let's jump into it kind of with a serious story. So a year ago today, 49 people were killed in the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. And now the owner, A year ago today, 49 people were killed in the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, marking it the US's most deadliest killing ever. Now, the owner, Barbara Poma, spoke out about the loss. Take a look at the video here.
I miss Pulse. I miss everything it stood for. I miss serving the LGBTQ plus community, our Latin community, in a way that only a gay bar can. I am grateful and comforted when I hear your memories and I see your pictures of the best times of your lives. It breaks my heart that your sanctuary was taken from you, but I know we are resilient. And I know we will not let hate win.
So obviously that was extremely moving. She also held a memorial service at the nightclub. Now the memorial service didn't actually begin until 1:45 a.m. with opening remarks from her about love and healing. Then at 2:02 a.m., the exact time that gunman Omar Mateen fired his first bullet, the ministers read aloud the 49 names of the dead. Now you can see here a picture of the large group that made a circle outside of the club. Now, Pulse has actually been boarded up since the event last year. But last month, Poma announced her plans to turn the site into a memorial and museum by the year 2020. Now, obviously, the shooting last year was devastating, but it was not the only time that the LGBTQ community faced a violent backlash. Now, excluding Pulse victims, 28 Americans who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender were killed in 2016, which was up 17% from 24 killed the previous year. Now, last year was actually the deadliest year for members of the LGBTQ community, which is really, really terrifying, right? Because I think this is a year or a time when we're supposed to be more tolerant and more accepting. And it's really, really unfortunate and sad that we are still facing, you know, these hate crimes. Now, including the Pulse victims from the numbers that I talked about before, murders of LGBT people rose 217%, okay? Now, obviously, people within the LGBTQ community, people of color, people with disabilities, are actually twice as likely as whites and able bodies to be the victims of harassment. And something that might surprise you is that most of the victims knew their attackers, who were commonly employees or employers, neighbors, landlords, and family members. So this is June is Pride Month. And so obviously that is why the attacker last year at Pulse targeted it that night. And so now as a way to sort of like remember what happened, I like that she is sort of coming out and, you know, saying that she's gonna now make a museum and a memorial for those members who passed away.
It's funny, I went by the Pulse nightclub, it was just a few months ago, and it's weird. I mean, I'm not down in that area ever, but I was on my way to a port to catch a boat. And we were passing, it was late at night, maybe it was 11 or midnight even. And it was, while boarded up, surrounded by flowers, surrounded by like a living memorials to what happened there. So that community is still very connected to that place and to remembering that history. And the other thing that strikes me is that it's kind of, as Hannah was saying, you know, this is a time when the LGBTQ community is taking such an assault. coming off of such victories, you know, the same-sex marriage acts, the strides that were made by those communities seem so significant. And now we find ourselves in a situation where that community is sort of on the defensive, I think, a bit.
I think members of that community have always been on the defensive, and I think that's what we're seeing in some of the reporting, or should I say lack thereof, that LGBTQ folks of color typically are the targets of violence. And this violence goes unreported. It's often not adequately covered, despite the fact that with Pulse, we see that folks of color were disproportionately affected. And even in certain pride marches, we still see LGBTQ folks trying to decenter whiteness as kind of the focus of these movements, despite the fact that instances of violence disproportionately affect people of color, folks who are not able-bodied or who are differently abled. So I think that despite the fact that there have been these this progress, that folks of color are still disproportionately negatively affected by violence within the community. So I think that that's kind of what I think the record or the report is getting at, is that we need some adequate coverage. And I think if we have more coverage, we also force a conversation around sexual identity and race, an intersectional conversation that I feel like we need to have when we talk about LGBTQ, you know.
I agree with you. I do think that we need to have more an intersectional conversation. I think the problem herein lies that there is a conversation that's happening in society right now, and unfortunately, it's on the wrong side. And I think that's a lot of the times why we're seeing this sort of uptick in violence, because Trump is, you know, passing these religious liberty executive orders. He is revoking protections for federal contractors and not protecting people of color, people within the LGBTQ community, disabled people. So there's so much of this rhetoric out there that I think that there is more of an acceptance for violence against them or hate speech against people within these communities than ever before. So it's a conversation that we don't really want to be a part of, and we need to shift it back to the progress that you were talking about and towards tolerance and acceptance.
But as Hannah says, that those legislative rollbacks are significant, right? It's not just the rhetoric, it's the fact that they're really rolling back legislative gains. So this is a turning point, and it's frightening because of the negative rhetoric and because of those moves. You need to have any kind of dialogue or any kind of conversation now, and it's harder to have it, much less an intersectional dialogue as you speak of. I think you make a really great point. I actually am embarrassed to say I hadn't really considered it, that, you know, within an oppressed community, there's even a more oppressed community. So, there's a lot, unfortunately, that's negative at this moment in time.
Yeah, very true. Moving on. In an effort to celebrate the start of Pride Month this June, Abercrombie and Fitch tweeted out that Pride is for everyone, not just the LGBTQ community, a sentiment that was rightfully met with a lot of backlash. Now, of course, this is a quote from Kayla, a merchandiser, and then she adds at the Trevor Project, which is a collaboration that Abercrombie & Fitch is doing with the Free Suicide Prevention Hotline for young LGBTQ people. So at least they're kind of doing something right there. Now, obviously, they got a lot of backlash for that tweet. And then they deleted the tweet and then responded with two pseudo apology tweets. It says, "Pride is an important time for the LGBTQ community. At ANF, we work to ensure that everyone feels included, respected, and empowered. Hashtag Pride." And then they said, "We are proud to show commitment to the LGBTQ plus community and to bring awareness to the important work the Trevor Project does." So they just missed that whole, like, "we're sorry" part. But otherwise, the sentiment was there. And I think a lot of people that are responding to this on Twitter are really calling to attention something really important here, because by saying the Pride community is everybody, not just LGBTQ people, they really miss the point, right? So Pride talks about being proud to be a part of this community, regardless of sort of the bigotry that you may face, right, as being part of that community. So it really is for that. Now, they're conflating two different issues here with being proud for being proud to be a part of that community. And then the other issue is being an ally for that community. Now, I do think that everybody can be an ally for that community. But what they basically did here with this comment from Kayla is sort of apply the All Lives Matter argument to the Pride community. And that is messed up. So I'm glad that people called them out. I wish they would have had a better apology. But they are, you know, trying to do work with the, you know, community, with their work with Trevor Project. So I want to give them credit for that. What do you guys think?
I think this is what happens when corporate interest supersedes a thoughtful understanding of an issue. Mm. We saw this with Pepsi. So although they are supporting the Trevor Project, you always have to call into question the motivation behind this support. And also, you know, do our research in examining what other corporations or interests that they serve. A lot of corporations kind of simultaneously support organizations that seem progressive and then organizations that fund mass incarceration or other kind of interests that disproportionately harm communities of color. So Abercrombie has never been on the right side of issues. This is not their first, misstep. So I'm just, you know, suspicious.
I mean, you said it right. Of course, it's the Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter thing all over again. It's right. Just simply that. And after that, it's how you backpedal from it and try to retain some dignity for your company, because right. It's clearly a grab of the spotlight, which is on this community, which needs the spotlight. Right. And now you're trying to nudge your way in as a company for commercial purposes. But it's that all over again. It's Black Lives, All Lives, all over again.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, with these sorts of scenarios, there is a really great opportunity for learning, right? That can be had if they had realized their misstep, realized that maybe Kayla minced her words, maybe she meant that we're all trying to be allies, whatever Kayla meant, we don't know. Or that, you know, as John brought up during the production meeting, that maybe this was just like an intern who didn't fully understand, sure, or whatever it may be. But it's still a great opportunity to be like, we're sorry, this that we messed up, but here's what we actually meant, and here are the ways that we're supporting this community. Mm-hmm. Now we're gonna feature all of our white super skinny models in gay relationships, whatever it may be, making sort of like
or
steps.
Feature real gay relationships.
I know.
Or hire people
facetious.
Of color, that would be great.
Or pretend gay relationships, or pretend people of color. We're gonna do something, right.
Yeah, they should have made a few more strides to remedy the situation. I mean, they should have made a few more strides to be
avoid
more supportive.
Yeah,
from the outset. But it is, I mean, I'm glad that people are dragging them for this, because it was a huge misstep, whether it be on Abercrombie and Fitch's shoulders or whether it be on Kayla's. Poor Kayla, it would really not be fun to be.
Well, before you insert yourself into an issue, make sure you know what you're talking about.
Yeah, by the way, it is true, just as an aside, I know we'll move on, but you know, you should run a tweet like that past somebody else. I mean, really.
No, I mean, the thing is like, there's no way that out of the entire Abercrombie, campus, that there was not somebody on the marketing team or the social media team who either is an ally or who is aware or who is a part of the LGBTQ community that saw this tweet and was like, maybe not a good idea. I never understand how these things sort of like slip through the cracks. All right, moving on to more fun. So former FBI Director James Comey testified in front of the Senate Select Committee and before America last week, and it turned out his ratings are gold. Now, roughly 19.5 million Americans tuned in on Thursday, even though the testimony was at 10 a.m. Eastern time, 7 a.m. Western. Now, to just put some of those numbers into context for you, that is about the same number of people who watched game 2 of this week's NBA Finals between the Golden State Warriors and Cleveland Cavaliers. Now, the viewership figure released on Friday by the television tracking firm Nielsen did not include statistics for PBS, C-SPAN, or the Fox Broadcasting affiliates that carried the hearing live. So obviously this number is a lot bigger than we're reporting right now. Nor did it include streaming platforms or those who congregated at viewing parties, which apparently was a very large percentage because apparently testimonies are our new Super Bowl. Now, Twitter and Bloomberg News also said that their joint live stream reached an average of 129,000 viewers a minute, which is insane. But Trump still gets bragging rights when it comes to ratings, because his inauguration brought in 30.6 million television viewers. Now, James Comey also called him a liar, and then Trump called him a liar back. But it turns out that most Americans actually believe what Comey has to say instead of Trump. Now, Huffington Post YouGov poll conducted on June 8 and 9 revealed that 46% of Americans consider Comey to be more honest and trustworthy than Trump. Now, on the other hand, only 26% believed Trump to be the more trustworthy one. And there was a slight difference between political parties there. Republicans were far more in favor of Trump, 58%, and chose him as the more trustworthy pick, while 78% of Democrats put their trust in Comey. So we have a problem that our Americans don't trust our president, but then it didn't really shift people's view of the administration, right? So 43% of those polled said that after Thursday's hearing, even though they didn't trust our president and they trusted Comey more after what he was saying, their view of the Trump administration stayed exactly the same. This is terrifying. This is absolutely terrifying.
This is one of those situations in which people get what they want out of it, though. You know, if you're already a Trump hater, if you already feel this administration is an abomination, an insult to what this country stands for, a money grab, an oligarch who has ascended through this already oligarchical machine. If you believe that, then it's like, yeah, look at James Comey. If you think this guy is a successful businessman, is trying to bring that success to Washington, all he needs is for people to get off his back and let him do his thing, then you kind of view Comey as this guy who's getting in his way. Mm-hmm. I think this is the country we're living in now. But you're right. When you look at those stark figures, it's hard to believe that everyone isn't on the same page, because so many are. You can't trust President Trump. He's demonstrably a liar. We know that.
Well, within the same exact poll, there was a majority percentage of people who also believed that Trump fired Comey over the Russian thing. So even though they want him to bring business back and bring jobs back, whatever it may be, the majority of people still think that they fired him over the Russia thing, which is still whether you're Republican or Democrat, that's still an obstruction of justice.
And I think what we miss in these numbers, right, about ratings and the fact that all of us were tuned in, is that there are a large swath of the population who was at work, right? Working class folks they care, but they want to know how this Comey issue is going to land on the ground in their everyday lives, right? So it's important, but I think there is this kind of disassociation between what's going on with Trump and Russia and Comey and the reality show of these trials and my everyday life. I've still got to go to work. I've still got to make ends meet. So how does this affect me personally every day? You know, whereas the rest of us, you know, I watch because I've never seen so many white men in court, you know, and this is and now we have Sessions, this is the best moment of time. I'm going to keep watching as long as they keep testifying.
I mean, the thing is I think there are a lot of portions of what we're seeing right now with the Trump administration that do appear to be a reality TV. But I think this was real life. I think this kind of brought everybody down to earth and was oh shit, this is actually happening. He has these contemporaneous memos that are detailing out how effed up our president is. And he's running our country and he doesn't know. And the excuse that we're getting from Republicans right now is that, this is his first rodeo, guys. Give him a break. And that's not an excuse for doing these sorts of effed up things.
Yeah, and he did call the president a liar, which is that was probably the crescendo moment. It came early on, but he did call him a liar. And the other way it's being really spun is that Well, this is a disgruntled guy because he was fired by this president. So you're here. That's the other way I think the right is spinning it.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible. And, you know, maybe that's why, even though he's like said in his contemporaneous notes, you know, he wasn't fired yet. And so he felt he had the need to take those. So maybe that's that. I think there's one really big positive takeaway from this in that, like, so many people are interested in politics and are seeing, whether they think it's effed up or they think that he's disgruntled or whatever it may be, people are tuning in and want to pay attention. Like, even when they can only watch part of it from work via, you know, a Twitter stream or whatever it may be, people are starting to pay attention. They want to be informed. They want to understand what's going on. And hopefully that motivates people and continues the activation that I think we've seen from the resist movement.
Yeah, if that does activate them to become involved in ways more than just watching this reality show, then it's a net win. What I worry about is, they're watching this thing. They're looking for a gotcha moment. Watching TV is fun, especially if there are a bunch of, you know, rich white guys on there lying. I mean, it plays like a Law and Order episode, or, you know. But the problem is, there's a lot of other stuff being done in the back rooms of Washington or in the front rooms of Washington. There's still a lot of public land being leased for mineral rights and all the rest. Trump is signing executive orders, taking away people's rights left and right. And so I hope, is my point, that you're right, that this activates people to be involved beyond just watching the Comey and ultimately the Sessions testimonies.
Yeah, no, there's one more point I want to make too on Comey's trustworthiness. And a lot of people online sort of made this parallel too. And I put out a tweet when I was watching it because a lot of the Republicans were like, why didn't you say something? Why didn't you tell him this was wrong? Why didn't you say stop? Which is something that I think a lot of women face in the workplace when they're dealing with harassment or something like that, and they deal with that victim blaming. So he still does, even though he sort of experienced something similar to that a lot of women experience in the workplace, he still does have the white male privilege in that the majority of people still think he's trustworthy and telling the truth. So at least he has that on his side.
That's a great, see, that's what you get when you have women on the panel. You get that perspective. I think that's a very good point. Sure. Yeah. That why didn't you say no?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's and his answer is probably that answer that, you know, so many people who would be female victims of sexual harassment. I was shocked. I didn't know what to.
Or anybody who's in the face of power and who doesn't want to, you know, lose their job.
Sure. So there's several parallels with sexual harassment, but also racial discrimination that people of color face in the workplace, that it's irrational, right? And I think that that's what we see. That's what I saw when I was watching Comey's testimony, is that white supremacy, racism, sexism is irrational, right? Mm-hmm. And that it. You often don't know how to respond because it's so ridiculous, it's so reckless, that your response is then irrational. But instead of calling into question the irrationality of the power structure, you get called into question, right? And they go into his credibility, right? These are folks who were once in support of Comey, who are now saying, you know, he's crazy. And so it does play out in ways that we see racial discrimination and sexual harassment cases play out.
Yeah, well, maybe as these conversations continue, he'll be asked what he was wearing. So we'll find out. All right, moving on. On our favorite state media program, Fox and Friends, Ivanka Trump was asked about the difficulty of being a part of the White House. And she talked about how vicious her father's critics are. Poor her. Let's take a look at the video.
Is it harder than you thought, though? Is it harder than you thought to stick to the things you want to do because of what keeps coming up, whether it's the Russia investigation or something else?
It is hard, and there's a level of viciousness that I was not expecting. I was not expecting the intensity of this experience. But this isn't supposed to be easy. Mm-hmm. My father and this administration intends to be transformative. And we want to do big, bold things. And we're looking to change the status quo. So I didn't expect it to be easy. I think some of the distractions and some of the ferocity was I was a little blindsided by on a personal level.
All righty. Oh, so I'm just going to reiterate some of my favorite quotes from that. She said, there's a level of viciousness that I was not expecting. I was not expecting the intensity of this experience, because somebody looks at the White House and they're like, meh, you know. Then she said,
you couldn't tell, by the way, from the way the Obamas were treated, that it might be kind of a rough ride.
Then she said, some of the distractions and some of the ferocity I was a little blindsided by on a personal level. Now, I have a lot of thoughts about this. One of which is that she said that a lot of the struggles that she is dealing with currently are made up for by the people that she meets when she's out on the road, poor or working class people that she gets to, that are, you know, greet her with smiling faces, because clearly they don't realize that her father's administration is going to totally F them over. Also, when we're talking about viciousness, I don't think that responding to the viciousness of her father's administration is necessarily, like, I definitely think he gets a lot of hate, right? But a lot of the times that's just in response to the viciousness that he is putting on our country. You know, when it turns, like, the way that he is treating immigrants, the environment, the LGBTQ community, women, minorities, Muslims, whatever it may be, that's the real viciousness that we should be talking about. Not that Ivanka Trump is getting some mean tweets.
Of course, he is the bully in chief. Before he even got to be president, he was taking on that Gold Star family. Remember the cons he just did? I mean, what a supreme miserable a-hole would do something like that. That's who her dad is. Don't lose sight of this. Let me tell you, and how long when he mocked that the handicapped New York Times journalist, okay? This is a guy, he's doing a mockery, like almost a theatrical mockery up there. The guy's despicable. This is her father. And then she has the gall to go on Fox and Friends. And by the way, very tough question that Fox and Friends asked. Is it tougher than you thought? Wow, that's the kind of journalism you can count on from them. Yeah. And she's shocked by this. It disgusts me.
Yeah, I don't think she's shocked. This is a strategy of white supremacy, right? This is how it operates. It promotes and perpetuates violence and then positions itself to be appalled by violence, right? This is what he does. This is what he's done on the campaign trail, you know, and it's not just the instances that you mentioned. It's the, I wanna punch him in the face, and I wanna, like, all of these things are violent things, and they're not subtly violent. They are actively violent. And of course, we use Ivanka, we use her femininity, we use her whiteness, we use her position and stature to go on and talk about feeling victimized or the ferocity of these, you know, the viciousness of folks against Trump. It's like, he couldn't go on TV and say he felt surprised, because he is the embodiment of this violence. So I don't buy it. I think it's ridiculous, and I can see right through it.
But do you think that it, I mean, maybe it's a ploy, maybe you're right. But at the same time, like, I think there's a chance that they live in this, like, bubble where they really do think that what they're doing might be right. Like, that is what is scarier to me. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think there's a chance that he may not realize how effed up he is.
I think we always do this when we always give folks, particularly white men, the benefit of, like, intent, or maybe they're too, even when they're stupid, right? It's like, oh, well, maybe they're too stupid. It's the same thing with Comey. He's never been president before. He's never served in an office before. So maybe he's just, you know, messing up because he needs to learn. You can't be, that can't be your first job. President cannot be your first job if you have no training. But it can if you're Trump, you know? So I think the benefit of the doubting white men is just ridiculous. I don't think that you are unaware of saying crazy things, and then when you hear crazy things back toward you, you're surprised.
Don't get me wrong, by calling him idiotic and bigoted and not living in a bubble, I'm not giving him the benefit of the doubt, but I think there might be a chance that he is just in this sort of, like, scary tornado, and people are just trying to, like move the tornado a little bit that way, move it a little bit this way. Nobody really has control over it. And I don't, like, of course, I'm not, you know.
No. I don't think that you're excusing him at all.
I'm not excusing. I'm not mentioning that.
No.
And I think both can be true.
Yeah.
I think it is true that Trump is dim. He's profoundly incompetent. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing. He's used to selling a bunch of crap based on slogans and stuff he just says. It's winning, winning, winning.
Yep.
This is going to be the best ever. This guy's the best ever. Don't worry. It's going to be incredible.
Right.
You just go to sleep. And when you wake up in the morning, it's going to be a new America. He's used to that stuff, so he doesn't really know that. But that is reinforced by that white privilege thing you're talking about. So I think in this case, those things coexist.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think sort of Ivanka really doubles down on that here. I remember when her Woman Who Work book came out and she was saying, God, I had to sacrifice. I gave up my massages, okay? And then she's basically doing the same thing here, trying to be a victim again, being like, I just didn't expect like these mean tweets. And she's sort of falling under these haters gonna hate sort of mentality when she doesn't realize that a lot of her inaction or action, you know, who knows whatever she's doing behind closed doors, are really affecting millions of people and earning this response. And one last thing that I want to say, she says, talks about the, you know, the ferocity of the people or her father's critics. And I think she's, you know, I guess talking about the resist movement. And I want the resist movement to stay ferocious. Like, I want them to keep up that ferocity.
Yeah. And all this obscures the fact that she has an office. It obscures all the nepotism that's happening. That's the question that we should be asking, is why are you serving in the administration? Instead of asking her how she feels about how her father is being critiqued.
Well, and
she's yourself in that position.
Yes, and I was going to say bent the ethic rules for the ethics rules for them, but not even. I mean, I think we've broken a bunch of ethics rules for them.
Absolutely.
As you say, she's in the administration. She still has businesses that are benefiting by certain decisions that are being made.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's a look. This is a horror show, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
But to have Ivanka Trump complaining about anything is insanity.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. All right, guys, we are going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Back on the Young Turks, Hannah Cranston here with Ambria Allen and Mark Thompson. So we are going to head into some of your TYT live tweets. Alex says, I love this community. We will never be taken down. We've survived thousands of years of hate and we will flourish. I love that spirit. Septian Patterson says, 1 year later and not one single piece of legislation for stricter gun laws. That's a really good point.
Well, you don't have to look past Newtown to see how there'll never be any restrictions on guns.
Yeah.
If you can gun down all those school kids and not get anything, then somebody blows a bunch of gay people away, and I think you've even a lesser chance. It's just the culture. It's despicable.
Yeah, you make a really good point. I don't know what else it would take besides kids. The next one is Woke Poppy. Says Abercrombie and Fitch talks about acceptance towards everyone. Didn't the founder say that ugly people shouldn't wear their clothes? Essentially. He also said, I think he like said something about people who were plus size. Mm-hmm. All of their ads feature just like very skinny white people in heterosexual relationships. So there's really no diversity, and they've had a bunch of issues facing like an employee who wanted to wear a hijab to work. Like, they've dealt with their fair share, and they should have sort of like taken a step back and be like, how should we approach this issue and do it the right way this time? But they unfortunately did not.
No.
Just Ray here says the gay community is just another minority being appropriated by corporations to gain consumer capitalization.
Right, that's what we were saying, is that they were just trying to nudge into the spotlight.
Right, and then Tarje Peterside says, seriously, if Ivanka is so concerned about viciousness, maybe she should talk to her dad about his administration's policies. Hmm. Yeah. Please do. Let's talk about some more viciousness from her dad's policies. Mm-hmm. So ICE agents have continued their tirade amongst immigrant communities, and this time they have arrested a teenager just hours before his prom. Now, this here is a picture of Diego Ismael Puma Macancela, who is a citizen of Ecuador, and he was arrested at his cousin's home on Thursday morning. Now, his cousin, Gabby Macancela, said a frightened Puma Macancela came to her apartment Wednesday night after his mother's arrest. Now, the following morning, she said they cowered in fear in one of the bedrooms when they heard agents banging on the door of her apartment. She says that he's not a criminal. He didn't do anything bad to nobody. He was just going to school, working. He was trying to make his dreams come true for him, for his family, for us. I don't know why. He's just a kid. Now, the agency said that Puma Mancancella is being held at a federal detention center and he is pending deportation. Now, the school was notified and they're going to work with attorneys to make him make it so that he can go back to school and finish up the school year so that he can graduate. But you know, this is where we are right now. This is the state of where we are, especially when it comes to immigration and the way that ICE agents are cracking down on immigration. Now, immigration arrests are actually up 38% under Trump, but deportations are down. Remember, they called Obama the deporter in chief. But 150% increase in these arrests are non-criminal. So obviously, that's the case here with Puma. So he is not a criminal, but you know, the other side would argue that being in the country legally is criminal, blah blah blah. But I think, you know, when we see all of these people that are being deported and being arrested by ICE agents, a lot of that sort of gets covered by, you know, all of the craziness that is happening with the Trump administration, with Russia, with Comey, whatever it may be. And it takes sort of these really sad cases, right? You know, the high schooler before hours before prom to really drive it home and have a more evocative effect for us to remember all of the awful things that ICE agents are essentially doing around the country.
Well, these are, cases like this are sort of the low-hanging fruit of the immigration problem. You know where these people are. They go to school. They have jobs. So they're not even really problem citizens in any way. But because you know where they are and they have jobs and going to school, you can round them up, which is what happened here. So it's oddly not solving any problems per se.
Right.
So it doesn't really fall under the banner of what ICE is, in essence, charged to do by this administration. Anyway.
It's not solving problems, it's actually creating problems, because a lot of the times local police work with their local immigrant communities so that they can deal with the problems from criminal immigrants, right? And so it turns out that in this case, that a lot the local police received prior notification that ICE would be in the local area conducting these targeted enforcement action. And they didn't really do anything about it and they didn't sort of provide that buffer. And so they are losing that trust from this community. And so it's going to create more problems, right? So when local police don't work with ICE agents, you know, that's called a sanctuary community. And those communities are a lot safer and have less crime than communities who do not do that.
Agreed. I think it does create a problem in that it undermines the efficacy of other justice efforts, like you were mentioning. Just the fact that under this administration that there are victims of domestic violence who are being targeted, right? Aspects of the justice system cannot operate effectively if you create this environment of fear, right? So it really is kind of, again, creating more issues than it is solving. And then also, you know, it's increasing the population of these private prisons that hold these folks before they are deported, which, you know, we get profit from. So.
Yeah, and so if you look at the meta problem of the immigration issue, I guess what we're saying is, you know, if you look at that as a weight on our society, economically or however, you know, this doesn't solve those problems. It doesn't address those problems. It, as Hannah says, creates more problems. And so you're taking productive members of the community, understood, they're here illegally, undocumented, but you're taking productive members of the community out. So there are many more issues, and I think you're both right to point out that the conjunction of local authorities and federal authorities has always been something that's been very important to this whole issue. And it seems as though that's breaking down a bit as well.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, that this is almost sending like the wrong message. Like, this kid is going to school and he's doing exactly what we want people who come to this country to do, is to have education and be, you know, great contributors to society. And so it is not even, it's actually being a detriment to the problems that we want to fix in our country, and especially people who are against, I guess, immigration at all. So it's a detriment to that, to take a kid out of school who could provide some sort of benefit to society.
And they typically do. Undocumented immigrants bolster our economy.
Of course.
Like, all of them, right? So, I mean, you know, outside of the criminal population that tends to be the focus of this legislation, let's try to have a productive economy without immigrants. And let's look at how many visas are provided by the US, right? And then look at that in relation to the revenue that is generated via taxes and via just the labor force that undocumented immigrants provide. So, if you are on the side of like being undocumented is criminal, then you need to take a deeper look, a critical look at how our economy functions.
Yeah, no, you make a really good point. I think one of the like co-founders of Google was an immigrant. Like there's so many different people who have contributed so greatly to our society that were immigrants. And then if we treat them like this, we're gonna lose a huge positive.
Well, by the way, and now I'm sorry, but and I know we're gonna move on, but I have to just quickly shoehorn this in. Economically, if you just want to talk the economics of it, illegal immigrants, undocumented immigrants are the backbone of so many businesses and they work in the shadows, they work in the kitchens, they work in the fields. And now, just as a result of sort of the advertising that we're going to be tough on immigrants in this country who are here in an undocumented way, there's been a chilling effect and they're having trouble staffing up those areas of the economy that depended. Again, this is sort of that you want to look at as sort of the gray economy. That's this undocumented population. So this country faces some issues in specific ways as a result of this policy and all of a sudden shaking the trees the way we are.
Yeah. No, you make a really, really good point. Moving on. Uber has been under fire quite a bit recently when it comes to harassment, bullying, and discrimination. But today, the company announced that they're actually going to be adopting some cultural changes and maybe even saying goodbye to their CEO, Travis Kalanick. Now, a spokesman confirmed that the board met with former Attorney General Eric Holder and Tammy Albarrán, both partners with Covington and Burling, which is a law firm that was hired to investigate complaints of widespread sexual harassment and other deep-seated cultural problems at Uber. Now, board members voted unanimously to adopt all of the firm's recommendations. I just want to take a trip down memory lane of some of the controversies that Uber has been dealing with. Back in February, former Uber engineer Susan Fowler wrote on a blog, she wrote a Medium article, that she had been propositioned by her boss in a series of messages on her first day of work and that superiors ignored her complaints. If you have not read this Medium piece yet, you should go back and read it. It is such a great explanation of how sexual harassment works in the workplace, how awfully some HR people respond. She also talks about some of the more seemingly innocuous types of sexism that can happen in the workplace, like some of the rewards were only given to males because there were only a few females and they couldn't make female sizes for them. There was all these crazy, crazy things that happened at Uber. So you should really read this. Now, as a result of some of the sexual harassment complaints that they get, because she was not the only one, a lot of people came out following that post. Uber announced last week that it fired 20 employees for harassment problems after a separate investigation by a different law firm. It also fired a separate executive who obtained medical records of a woman who accused her Uber driver in India of raping her. And then he shared those medical records with other executives, including Kalanick, who believed that the rape victim was making her story up as a way to discredit Uber in the Indian marketplace. So if that doesn't give you an idea of what this culture is like, I don't know what will. Further, CEO Kalanick has had some issues of himself. I'm sure you remember the viral video of him yelling at an Uber driver who was complaining about pay. And he basically said, like, some people just want to blame their shit on others and they don't take accountability, which was a lovely moment. And some other insights into his personality can be seen from a 2014 email that he sent out to employees during a retreat in Miami. It read, "Do not have sex with another employee unless A, you have asked that person for that privilege and they have responded with an emphatic yes, I will have sex with you. All right, consent, I'm into that. B, the two or more of you who do not work in the same chain of command." Then he says, "Yes, that means that Travis will be celibate on this trip. Hashtag CEO life, hashtag FML." There were also other references to drug use on the trip, a puke charge, not throwing kegs off of buildings. So clearly Uber has a culture problem. They're working to fix that. The board has approved the changes that the law firm recommended. There's no word whether or not Kalanick will be leaving. He talked about before all of this happened that he might consider taking a leave of absence. His mother recently passed, so he might want to take a leave of absence there. I think there's some other reasons that he might consider taking a leave of absence. What do you guys think about this?
It's interesting to me. How long has Uber been around? Like how many? Not very long.
Yeah, and back in 2014, they only had 400 employees, and now they have nearly 9,000 workers.
Right, so a couple of years. How do you already have deep-seated cultural issues? So, right, so when we talk about places like Fox News, we tend to blame the issues of sexual harassment on these kind of cultural norms that are entrenched in a particular generation of sexism, right? But with Uber, we see that like sexism is not a generational issue, like it's a cultural problem.
Yeah, but whatever, they were around for a few years. I mean, I think like you were on Silicon Valley, like you know that is a huge problem with these Silicon Valley tech problems. Like it doesn't surprise me that they have huge cultural issues because a lot of these tech companies do.
But your point is also that you in mentioning Fox News, you're saying, hey, those old guys, that's kind of the way they used to do business in the 50s and 60s or whatever.
No, I'm saying that we cannot blame the issues of sexual harassment on this generational cultural trend
that
is through and through.
It crosses, right?
They've been around for 5 years and we've got issues with sexism, right? Yeah. So when we talk about sexual harassment in the workplace, let's put the blame on sexism and misogyny, not on generational norms or certain issues that we try to shift the blame.
I think the problem is I agree with you. It is completely through and through. But I think the problem is that we're in the year 2017, and we have all these laws now and all of these different infrastructure things that are in place to prevent this. And we know better now, even though we should have known better then. And so the fact that this shit is still happening is messed up. I'm glad they're trying to fix it by changing the culture. I hope they get a new CEO who prioritizes these things a little better. No. All right, guys, that is it for this show. We will see you guys later. Bye-bye.
Bye.